Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and I think we can all agree we live in a youth-obsessed culture that dreads aging, but we also live in a country with an aging population, loads of retiring so-called baby boomers, and a fierce political debate over Medicare spending. My next guest, cultural critic Margaret Morgenroth Golett, wants to change the way we talk about and treat aging in our culture, and she's written a new book called Age Wise, Fighting the New Ageism in America. She joins me now. Margaret, welcome to WNYC.
Jamie, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I was on with my previous book, Age by Culture. Now you're getting into Age Wise, too.
Well, we're so pleased to have you back, and I very much enjoyed that conversation that you had then and your previous book. Let's talk about this book, Age Wise. First of all, why do you think we dread aging? You have a unique take on it. Do you think it's because we're afraid to die, or do you think it's because of ageism in the culture?
Well, yes, the emphasis of the book is on ageism in the culture. And I think, in fact, that that whole sentence, we fear aging. I think a lot of people now, if they knew it, would fear ageism. And I just want to give an example from last night. I was giving a talk at Brookline, which is a sort of posh suburb of Boston, and several of the people, and I was talking about midlife job loss. Well, midlife job loss is just an enormous problem in the United States. We have millions of people for whom it is becoming the norm to lose their job and to not be able to get another one afterwards. And we have had, here's a typical case. Then this one went to trial, so we know about it. An employer says to his underlings, "We need new blood." And then employees over 40 get fired, or they don't get promotions.
Yeah, and in the book you use the phrase "young blood." Employers love that phrase, "young blood."
It's a quote from the text of the AARP did an amicus curiae brief. It's a quote from some. It's not alleged. It actually was said. So but what happened last night is a woman came up to me beforehand and she said, "I haven't been able to get a job for 10 years, a real job. And should I dye my hair?" Oh, okay. I said, "Let's talk about it afterwards." Afterwards, she came up to me and she told me her whole sad story. I mean, she's done everything that you're supposed to do. She changed her resume. You know, she doesn't have her age really indicated anywhere. And she said to me, "I am just going to throw myself on the train tracks if this goes on."
Now I want to hear from our listeners because I imagine we have many, many listeners who share the concerns of the woman you were talking with last night, who will run out and grab your book, but also who perhaps have questions about the thesis. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Do you encounter ageism on a daily basis, weekly basis, or perhaps not at all? If you're an older person, do you think ageism affects the way people see you or the way you see your own life? Or if you're a younger person, do you have any fears about getting older? And if you do, why do you think you do? 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. My guest is Margaret Morgenroth Golett. And Margaret, I really found compelling your argument that we should battle ageism as strongly as we do racism or sexism or other forms of bigotry. But you say that ageism is very casual in the culture and very institutionalized, right? So how do we go about battling it if sometimes we're not even aware it's there?
Well, I think there's, read my book, you know, you'll find out the many, many places that it exists.
Can you give us some examples as you do in the book?
Well, I know legal analysis is your major interest. I mean, I am not a legal person, but I was just horrified to find out that how the Supreme Court has been institutionalizing what I call middle ageism. I think we need this term in the culture because these people who are losing their jobs are people over 40, and it's illegal to fire people because of their age. Mm-hmm. It's illegal. It's in the ADEA, which is the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. So I was shocked when I first heard about Kimmel versus Florida Board of Regents. And it turns out that the justice who wrote the opinion said, and I'm going to quote this, because people don't believe that a Supreme Court could have decided this. States may discriminate on the basis of age, unquote. I mean, this just blew my mind. And there's an even more important Supreme Court decision, which is Gross versus FBL Financial Services. And it just says you can do it to employers because to employees, rather, because they cost more. Now, this is really not at all what Congress had in mind when they passed the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. And I'm glad you got on the institutionalization because these are the things where people joining an anti-ageist movement can actually have an effect. I mean, you can lobby your Congress people to override that Supreme Court ruling in Gross.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
and on Supreme Court jurisprudence, and I want to focus on your book and not on the Supreme Court because
okay.
We just did a whole segment on the Supreme Court.
Right.
But race is the most suspect class in Supreme Court jurisprudence, and age and gender and other forms, sexuality, are not as suspect, and so the scrutiny for discrimination is not as great. That is a fascinating segment, and perhaps Brian will consider doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But as to your book, I want to take a call. Gail in Manhattan is with us. Gail, hello. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. Thanks you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I think there's two primary things that your guest brings up, and one of them is that a lot of times hiring older workers is because the boss in charge does not want the history, meaning the older workers who've been there for a long period of time and even who have seniority know sometimes where the bodies are buried. So if you have new, younger workers, it takes them a while to catch up to that history. And then the other thing that was mentioned, which is I'm a adjunct professor, and a lot of times you're basically a part-time employee. Adjunct professor is a very nice name for a part-time employee who isn't getting benefits and who isn't getting any kind of tenure. And it's an awful thing to look at current tenured or non-tenured professors who you're brought in to basically terrorize them. Well, we have this other person. They work for less money. They work here part-time. They're very disposable, but you are as well.
And Gail, thank you very much for your call. Those are two very astute observations. And in your book, Margaret, you also make, I think, very eloquently the point that ageism produces some fear and shame and self-reflection on the part of the individuals, wide-ranging effects that not just for individuals in their own lives, but collectively for the society at large. Can you talk a little bit about this terror of forgetfulness that you say we've sort of created in our society, this escalating dread about memory loss that is affecting our relationship to one another?
Yes, thanks. I think it very much, this fear of memory loss very much feeds into middle ageism. One of the arguments against midwife workers, aside from the ones that Gail mentioned, is that they're somehow not as clever or up to date. Usually this is in the tech field, but it works in other fields too, including it could work in academics, is because they are not so quick cognitively. And lose your car keys, kill yourself is sort of what And I don't think that this is. People tell me all the time at these talks that they are afraid of not only of losing their memories, but of appearing to lose memory. And I think we see all the time that teenagers, just to mention one age group, have a lot of trouble with memory.
Sure.
Every time they take a test and they haven't done well on it, you know that there's a problem with memory. But it's when it's age graded that we begin to get these larger social consequences.
That's right. And I mean, when you forget your keys and you're 25, you don't think anything of it. But the minute you round 40 and you forget your keys, as you perhaps always have, you begin to think that perhaps it's age-related or that someone will perceive that it's age-related. Let's take a call from George in Manhattan. George, we just had a call from Gail, who is an adjunct professor, and I understand that you are a teacher as well.
Yes, I'm a teacher.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, the whole crux of the educational situation here in New York City particularly, but also throughout the state, with the test results of students to justify has to do with age, because by and large teachers are concerned about pupils' understanding of a subject, not necessarily their ability to answer a test question. For years, I taught test prep programs for SAT test preparation, and the whole thing was anxiety reduction, making them more and more aware of what the how the test question was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you spend all your time teaching kids how test questions are constructed, and you teach them how to, you know, basically time manage in a test situation, you're not teaching them the material nor the understanding of it. Likewise, when you take tests, it's the people that are able to speed read and realize what test questions they are able to answer that do best on the test. So basically a whole host of material is just grossed over if you can just pick out the items that you know. And unfortunately, the age discrimination is what we're talking about here, is that older teachers tend to want their pupils to understand the material, necessarily do well on a test question.
Well, imagine that. George, thank you, George, for your call.
You're welcome.
It's interesting that the older teachers are teaching that model, and George suggests at least that perhaps younger teachers are teaching on an entirely different model. And it's also interesting, Margaret, that we got two calls from teachers. My name is Jamie Floyd. I'm in for Brian Lehrer, and my guest is Margaret Morgan-Roth-Golett, whose new book is Age-Wise, Fighting the New Ageism in America. Margaret, how do you think the political debate about Medicare would be different if we didn't live in an ageist culture?
Well, I think Paul Ryan's proposal would have been dead on arrival.
that's fair enough, but you say a bit more about it in your book. You suggest that policy, the book isn't just about ageism, it's quite a bit about policy.
Yes. Well, I think we've had attacks on Social Security for about 30 years that come from people who want to privatize Social Security. I think the Medicare debate is moving into, and just to finish the thought about Social Security, and that may not work. I mean, Social Security is not really in trouble and won't be for decades, and privatizing it would destroy it. Well, the Medicare debate goes even deeper into ageism, I think, because there are many ways of saving money on Medicare, and one of them is to get pharmaceuticals cheaper, the way the Veterans Administration does. Congress could permit Medicare to bargain the way the VA does. So there are other ways of saving money on Medicare. What I fear is going to happen, is already happening, is that end-of-life care will be the strategic wedge, that's where people will go to save money, because the myth in American culture is that end-of-life care is just expensive and unnecessary. And I feel very strongly that we have an obligation to everybody to give them choice in dying. I think we have to give people a good enough death. And just to speak pragmatically, a very small percentage of people have very high cost death. That's about 3% of people who die over 65. So I would like to see the debate focus on that 3%. I wouldn't like to see the debate focus on that 3%. I think if we had a less ageist society and we said we have only 3% of people who they really seem to want and their doctors think they need these procedures, and it may give them more life. And I think here of my senator, Teddy Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
He got the best care you could get for a brain tumor. And we followed it in the papers here, with real heart, I think. And he lived 18 months. And he lived in a normal 18 months. It was very touching. I mean, he congratulated Lilly Ledbetter when that act went through. He went sailing with his wife and family.
But his circumstances were quite extraordinary. And most people don't have that kind of care at end of life. And as you suggest, most people don't have that kind of circumstance, 3%, that kind of death. And I think you would probably agree that we're not anywhere near having the kind of conversation about end of life that you're suggesting we should have. In fact, we're not, and this is the entire point of your book, even talking about aging, let alone end of life conversations.
Well, we're having a lot of talk about aging. I mean, and we have a lot of talk, 90 is the new 70 and so on. I mean, there's plenty of talk in the culture about how dreadful physiological aging is.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a lot of discourse that does. I mean, it interests people, even that side.
But just your last statement suggests mm-hmm. that we as a culture treat aging more like a disease that can somehow be cured, that 90 can become the new 70 and 70 the new 50 and 50 the new 30, as if somehow
right.
the old 50 was so bad
right.
and the old 70 was so dreadful. Do we treat aging like a disease that can be cured? And do you agree with that suggestion? And was there ever a point where we were less ageist as a culture and society?
Well, I just to answer the first question, I think that age as a collection of diseases is a marketing tool. And we have an enormous commerce in aging. We have the dysfunction industries that tell you basically that your sexual life is going to decline. And there are young people who believe that this is true. They think it declines at the age of 30. We have the industries that tell you that you're ugly, so that you will want to buy cosmetics or plastic surgery. And the book has a chapter called Plastic Wrap, which is actually about how people are turning away from plastic surgery.
Mm.
So, I mean, why don't Americans know that people since 2004 have been turning away from plastic surgery?
Well, they certainly know now, and I would urge them to get your book, Margaret Morgenroth Golette. Her book is Age Wise, Fighting the New Ageism in America. I thank you so much, Margaret.
Well, thank you, Jamie. It's been fascinating.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and coming up next, I will be joined by Gretchen Morgenson, business and financial reporter for The New York Times.